Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Salut Rokaya.
Salut Grace.
Salut les auditrices.
Vous trouverez la suite de Kif Taras et les nouveaux épisodes à écouter sur votre plateforme habituelle de podcast.
Faites simplement une nouvelle recherche avec le titre Kif Taras chez Pseudo Radio et abonnez-vous à ce fil.
Bien sûr, les 4 premières saisons des épisodes de Kif Taras resteront toujours disponibles chez Binge Audio.
Merci pour votre écoute précieuse
et à bientôt.
Binge Audio.
Bonjour Rokaya.
Bonjour Grace.
Bienvenue dans cet nouvel épisode bonus en anglais de Kif Taras, le podcast qui saute à pieds joints dans les questions raciales.
Donc les mots qui vont suivre seront exceptionnellement en anglais. On fait un crossover avec un podcast néerlandais qui s'appelle Deep Sauce. Donc on va parler évidemment, comme d'habitude, de noirs, d'arabes, de blancs, d'asiatiques, de roms, de musulmans, voilà, de tout ce qui s'ensuit. Mais cette fois-ci en anglais. Donc nous vous remercions d'être à l'écoute.
So our guest for today are our twin sister podcast from France. I hope you agree with that.
Yes, of course. We do. We're very happy to have family in the Netherlands.
Right, podcast family. So Kif Taras. Kif Taras is a binge audio podcast hosted by Rokaya Diallo and Grace Lee. I had a look at the episodes, and that's why I kind of came up with, you know, our sisters. I can't really listen long and really understand fully what is, it's very hard to follow a French conversation that goes over in a way, you know, in a quick pace, because French is so quick.
Do you speak French? You speak a little French?
I'm Moroccan. I'm okay. Dutch Moroccan. I grew up in the Netherlands, but I speak like Maghrebian French. So when I used to travel to our cousins and our aunts in Barbès and in Saint-Denis, but I don't think you would understand. I'll mix it with like Moroccan Arabic and make it work. Like in Pantin, they understand what I'm saying. So we're super excited. So welcome, Rokaya and Grace.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you. And we always like to introduce our guests with three questions that we kind of borrowed from the Surinamese community here in the Netherlands. And what they always ask is, who are you? What do you do? And where does your house live?
Okay, I'll start. My name is Grace Lee. I am a writer and the co-host of the podcast Kif Taras with Rokaya Diallo. And my house is somewhere around Paris. It looks a little Southeast Asian. It's also very French. And it's home to me. It's a mix of all these, my heritage. My parents are Chinese Cambodians who came to France in the 70s. And I was born and raised in France. So my house is a mix of everything that I have encountered until now. How about Rokaya?
So my name is Rokaya. We can say, I think in Morocco, people say Rokaya.
Yeah.
So
Rokaya. Yeah. I have an aunt. Her name is Rokaya.
Yeah, so it's, what was the second? Oh, yeah. I'm a filmmaker and a journalist and also a writer. And my house is in Paris, where I was born, actually. It's very close to the place I grew up in the northeast of Paris. So it's a place where my parents came from Senegal. They came and they settled there. And I live in almost the same neighborhoods as I used to as a kid.
And how about you guys?
My name is Mariam Al-Maslohi. I live in The Hague, in the so-called city of justice and right, but that's not really true. I live here for 3 years. I work actually in politics. I work for a leftist political party. It's a local party. I do that with a lot of love and fatigue. And I am one third of the Dipsaus podcast. We started in 2016. So that's what I do. And I kind of ended up also making other podcasts than this one. So I'm also a podcast producer, editor. And so that's a little bit me. And sometimes my soul lives in Morocco, and sometimes it comes to join me here.
And ABC.
ABC, yes.
Yes. I'm originally from Ethiopia. I was born in Ethiopia, and I was actually 14 when I came to the Netherlands. So I was a teenager. And both my parents live here. I came here with my parents. Because my father is a... He's a political refugee. He had to flee the revolution in the 70s. And what do I do? Oh, besides Dipsaus podcast, I work for the Dutch Council for Culture as a policy advisor and communications. So we advise what happens to the millions that the government doles out to the various cultural institutions. That's a part-time job. And I'm also an editor. I make books.
Okay.
We just published our, I have been working in the publishing world, in the literary publishing world for over 15 years. And 2 years ago, we decided to go solo with the podcast. So besides producing other podcasts and also an online magazine and essays, we also, we are publishing books, and our very first book just got published a month ago. The Dutch version of the English The Good Immigrant.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, congratulations.
Has it been translated
or is it only available in Dutch?
No. That's the thing. We did not want to translate from English. You had the English one?
No, I was wondering if your book was available in any other language.
No, it's okay. Only in Dutch, because we just got published, and to translate it from Dutch into any other language, it's a lot of money, and we don't have that kind of... If a publishing house picks it up, it would be really interesting, because what we wanted to do is also, we kind of know the story of the Anglo-American immigrant experience because of the language, but whatever is happening on continental Europe, be it Dutch, French, German, Swedish, it's invisible. So that was the reason why we wanted to do like original Dutch stories and not necessarily translate it from...
Yeah, I feel the same. I know a lot more about things happening across the Atlantic, for example, in the USA, and less about my home continent, Europe. And it's great to have this conversation with you, because I think we probably share a lot of common things, being women of color and also being Europeans, because obviously since 1957, the creation of the European entity, I'm sure we share lots more in common regards to law, regards to, I don't know, but many public conversations, and just having this one now is making this very interesting. And in Kif Taras, we address racial questions in France, and we have a ritual question that we ask our guests. Would you agree to answer this question?
Of course.
So we ask our guests to situate, to tell us where they speak from with regards to race matters. For example, I'm perceived as an Asian, East Asian woman, and Rokaya is perceived as a Black woman. And do you girls, are you perceived in a certain way? And which one is it? Or do you perceive yourself? You already mentioned it, Mariam, earlier. And when did this start?
That's such a good question. I think first and foremost, I always see my identity as something very fluid. So something that changes sometimes just only where I am, who I'm with, and what country I am. So in the Netherlands, I look at what identity of mine is extremely politicized. So me being a Moroccan Muslim woman is something that's being very politicized. That is a subject to discuss almost weekly. So I see that the subject on Twitter that trends a lot is the hashtag Marocana, hashtag le Marocain, the Moroccans. So that is an identity of mine that is spoken about a lot on TV by politicians in a very racist way. But when I walk on the streets, I'm not necessarily recognized as the Moroccan woman. I am an Afro-Moroccan, so I am from the south of Morocco, where I have a strong heritage of Black Moroccans, a heritage of what I don't know, but could be possible also of slavery. So when I walk in the south of Morocco, I'm just like any other. When I walk the streets in the Netherlands, I would have to start speaking Moroccan to be recognized as a Moroccan and maybe even as a Muslim woman. So I speak from those layers of identity, and depending on the conversation we have, I sometimes kind of decide from what starting point. If, for example, if I talk a lot about sexuality, the exotism of my Muslimness or Moroccanness or even Arabness is something that is put on in discussion. So it's a discussion I have internally also a lot. I think I could explain it like that. You know, post 9/11, I think also in Paris, what I've heard, 9/11, to grow up as a teenager in Europe, as a Muslim, your identity as a Muslim was something that was very highlighted. So I have lots of layers, and today I will be speaking from all those layers because we are here in that intersectional, you know, space.
And thank you. What about you, Ebise?
It's interesting. When you asked that question, I wrote down what came to me first. And as I'm going to say first what I wrote down, and then whilst Mariam was talking, I started rearranging my also very fluid identity, multiple identities. The first thing I wrote was like, I'm Black first, and then African, then Ethiopian, then Oromo. I'm from the Oromo ethnic group. But then, again, all these are dependent on my geographical location, but also the metaphysical world of specifically Europe and then Dutch whiteness. I think within the Dutch white space, I'm a Black woman. That's how I'm perceived. And after living here for over, what, I think 25, 26, 27 years, that has become the identity that has been imposed upon me. And that's also the identity I've accepted. But if I am within Dutch Blackness, within the Black Dutch community, then I become African Black, because the Dutch colonial history, the largest Black community in the Netherlands, they are from the Afro-Caribbeans, from the Dutch Antilles, the Six Islands and Suriname. Those are the most visible Black people in the Netherlands. And people tend to put me in that category because according to a lot of, I don't have like the typical Ethiopian East African look. But then within within the African Blackness, then I'm East African. I would identify as specifically the Horn, and especially with the us Ethiopians and Somalis and Eritreans, we tend to get together. But then if I'm Ethiopian, then I'm Oromo first, because of, I don't know whether you know the situation in Ethiopia, but the Oromo ethnic group is one of the largest ethnic groups in Ethiopia, but it's also one of the most oppressed ethnic groups where there's a lot of turmoil going on. So, and for me, I cannot hide my Oromo-ness when I'm amongst Ethiopians, because my parents gave me in the 70s a very distinctly Oromo name. Ebise is a very Oromo. You cannot, there's no way that you can not label me as a non-Oromo, whereas for survival reasons, a lot of Oromos back in the days gave Amhara names to their Oromo children. So with me, I cannot escape my Oromo-ness when I'm amongst Ethiopians. That's the first thing they ask is like, that's a weird name. Where are you from? I even get that within. So what I'm trying to say is like, even in the Netherlands, depending on who I am with, how I identify is fluid. But then mostly, yes, I'm a Black woman, I would say, because I live in Europe. That would be like the main identity mark.
Great. And how did you ladies meet, and how was the Deep South podcast created? What was the conversation that sparked the creation of the podcast, and how would you define the podcast with regards to the race matter, the race issue in the Netherlands?
So funny. I want to ask you the exact same question.
Ah, that's great.
So we'll answer after you.
You will answer after us. Okay, cool.
I mean, I love this. I love this. Like, we're all so curious. Like, oh, but what do you? And let's see. So we started in 2016. And so me, Abise, and Anusha, the three of us, we kind of knew each other just from Twitter, from the Twitter community, let's call it that. But we were interviewed, but not with Abise, with four other women of color and Black women. And we talked about race, using social media. And we kind of, I don't think we made the mistake. I think we let a white journalist interview us, a white male journalist. And we made some very, very strict agreements, and those agreements were not honored. So what happened was that a article was published that was that led to a meltdown in the Netherlands, where we kind of said what we are saying, and I'm pretty sure you are saying in the podcast, that we have a racism problem, and we have a problem with how we, even as women of color, as Black women, can move through this country, work, etc. And so we didn't really know each other that well, but because we were so under a magnifying glass, and because we were attacked constantly, we created this WhatsApp group app and started talking about, you know, our experiences, what is going on, about the debate in the Netherlands, etc. And then we thought, you know what, we have this safe space now, but what if we just throw it into the world and into the in the Netherlands? And that's how DipSauce actually was created. And we're going strong now for...
You forget one tiny detail. The three of us, we met at different stages before that's we true. Started the podcast, because Anusha is like, she's our eldest as well. She has been... how do you say it? She's been an activist. She's relatively well known in the Netherlands. She's a writer.
Yeah.
She's an actress. She has been a public figure for a long time, but she was one of the few outspoken Black women since the beginning of days. She's one of the trailblazers, and she'd had to deal with all of this on her own for a long time. But I met Mariam at a protest.
First
time we actually met, it was Twitter, but then the first time we saw each other was at a protest. And the same with Anusha. The first time I actually saw her in real life was another anti-racism protest. So even if before we knew that Dips House was going to happen, we actually physically met at anti-racism protests. I just wanted to add that.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Comment devenir un ou une meilleure alliée de la lutte antiraciste ? Comment se confronter à ses privilèges en tant que personne blanche ? Chez Binge Audio Édition, on sort Mécanique du privilège blanc, un livre d'éducation antiraciste pour proposer des outils concrets à toute personne qui souhaite se confronter à ses privilèges. Le livre est signé Estelle Depri, qui anime depuis des années la page Instagram Semblant de Rien, sur laquelle elle produit du contenu antiraciste qui permet à chacun et chacune de devenir un meilleur allié. Vous êtes déjà plus de 2000 à avoir précommandé. Grâce à vous, on a dépassé notre objectif. Il ne vous reste que quelques jours pour commander vous aussi votre exemplaire. Rendez-vous sur ulule.com/mécanique-du-privilège-blanc ou sur le compte Instagram de Binge Audio Édition.
What about you?
Yes, we want to know now about you.
So it's a different story because we knew each other. We were already friends and we were keeping having those conversations about racism, how Grace as an Asian woman was experiencing race in France and how it was different from my own experience and how in some ways it could be similar. So we're having those conversations with, you know, the two of us or with other friends. And at some point we have that conversation saying, oh, maybe we could have the conversation, you know, in a more public way and trying to create a space where we could have that conversation, but not in the traditional way, because here in France, we have many debates, TV debates, where you have people discussing race or the French identity, but in a very, very aggressive way, like something that is not peaceful at all. And it's mostly, you know, among white people, just speaking about people who are not there. And it's very, you know, it's not, you know, very peaceful conversation. So we decided to first have invite two of our friends, Fatima Aidbounoua and Samira Ibrahim, to have a taped conversations, like a video conversation. We didn't have, like, we were thinking of creating a podcast, but we didn't really know how to do. So we just taped a video. And then I met Joël Ronès, who is the head of Binge Audio. And I remember I had a meeting with him and I just sent him the link of the video. And I went to the meeting and he was like, he understood everything that we wanted to do. And he asked me to get in touch with Grace so that we could have a pilot. Yeah, kind of pilot episode with two guests. And that's how it started. I don't know if you have something more to add. Or...
Yeah, I think Rokaya said it really well. And I think what I can relate with your experience is that just like I think from what I understand from the Netherlands, France has a problem with race. We cannot talk about race in a public manner, but it's supposed to stay intimate, you know, how we talk about race. France sees itself as a white country. And actually, when I think of the Netherlands, I also think of a white country. I will see the tall, blonde, blue-eyed woman or boy. I think France markets itself as a white country. And therefore, with the colonial history that I inherited, because my parents come from an ex-colony, an ex-protectorate of France, Cambodia, and some countries in Southeast Asia, just such as Vietnam, Laos, were part of the French Empire back then. And I think that's what I found talking to Rokaya, is that we are French and we were both born here, but we are seen as non-French by the French people themselves. So I guess this is something that I can relate to from your what you said, and also other European podcasts. We spoke to a British podcast called No Country for Young Women, and from the BBC, and both of them also had this feeling of living in their country as foreigners, and that's something that I think will makes it very European as opposed to the USA. People who live in the USA maybe probably have a different story, because the USA and Europe have different stories, obviously. And the relationship with heritage is different, and space-wise and time-wise. And I think that's something that I can relate.
Yeah. And even regarding the identity of the country of the US, for example, because race is structural to the US identity. There is no way an American person can deny the fact that that, you know, black people have been there forever, or native people, they've been there since even before the US were labeled the United States of America. Whereas in Europe, we still have this idea that people are coming, that they are newcomers. And even if we've been here for centuries, we are still seen as people who just came yesterday. And it's you know, it's something that we need to tell and to tell over and over. Because there is no real consciousness of the fact that we are part of the European, we've been part of the European history for a long time, and the Netherlands as well as France has been very strong and powerful colonial states. They've been part of the slave trade, they've been part of the invasion of the rest of the world, and they are still have those the legacy of that story in their walls, in their traditions. I've been covering a story about Zwarte Piet in your country, and it's something that is there that we can, you know, we can see in the traditions in every public space.
Yeah, that's true. I completely agree, and especially when the times I have visited France is. To us, I hope I can speak also for you, Evise. To us, what has always been important is to have that conversation amongst us, avec nous. Who are we? And let's do that without what was so important to us is to do that without the interruption. I call it kind of the interruption of whiteness, so that we, as people of color, with and not with the erasure of where we are from and the erasure of what our experience is. I mean, my experience is very different than of Ebise's, and Ebise's experience is different from mine, but that we at least have the conversation because we have something in common, and that's we live in Europe or we live in the Netherlands. And that brings a certain, as you said, that brings a certain history and that brings a certain legacy. What I am so interested in when I look at France and see how people of color interact in a different way when you have a colonizer in common. So, you know, I see a different relationship when it comes to North Africans with West Africans, but specifically West African countries that have been colonized by the French, because you have a language in common, you have a kind of a colonizer in common, which creates a very, and I might be wrong, but I always had kind of the sense that there was more closeness than we might have in the Netherlands. I don't, my parents do not remember the French marching through Morocco, the Dutch marching through Morocco. Those were the French. So there was always created this kind of fake neutral way I should live my life here in the Netherlands because we're newcomers and we don't have that legacy in Morocco, for example. But for the Surinamese, like Ebise said, for the Indonesians, there is that colonial history. And I just hope that with our conversations that we have, that we grow closer to each other and have that conversation. And that is something we tried also to do in the book, for example, where it's intergenerational, it's you know, we make a difference between being black and being a non-black of color, and hope we have that conversation, if I'm making any sense.
Yeah, it is interesting. The situation in the Netherlands is indeed slightly different than the situation, for example, in the UK or France specifically, because of after the Afro Caribbean community, the largest community of color in the Netherlands are the Moroccan Dutch and the Turkish Dutch migrants that came in the 70s for what's gastarbeiter?
Laborers.
They brought them in large, just like in Germany. So as a result, because there is no colonial history with, I mean, not the similar colonial history with the second and third largest Muslim community in the Netherlands, that the system, the Dutch system, has been able to divide and conquer. So as the people of color community in the Netherlands, the largest groups, the Afro-Black community and the Moroccan and the Turkish community, they were not necessarily grouped together because they don't have similar, they both had colonial histories different from different vantage points. The Turks were not colonized by the Dutch. The Moroccans were not colonized by the Dutch. So it has a slightly different way of relating to the Dutch as a colonizer than, for example, the Moroccans in France or the Moroccans in Belgium. That's what it makes it, it's a strange cocktail of whiteness that the Dutch have managed to create. And the fact that the Dutch language is also like spoken in a very, only few people compared to France, French and English, they have managed to create this Valhalla of freedom and tolerance. The Dutch and their tolerance is like their world famous. They export tolerance.
It's a lie. I'm telling you now, it's a lie.
Yes, I was going to ask you because that's the only thing that's not the only thing, but that's what I take from Amsterdam because, well, I only know Amsterdam from the Netherlands. And I always thought, oh, wow, they're, you know, they are so tolerant. They can smoke weed. Well, from a long time, you know, now I know it's different now, but they can smoke weed and sex workers are treated differently than in other countries. And I always had this idea that, you know, Dutch people were more open-minded. And I was wondering when you said, and you answered my question, that...
not race, it's more drugs and sexual freedom and not necessarily race. Race was not part of the equation.
Yeah, because I remember when I spent some time in Amsterdam to make that story about like the slave trade past that was trying to be hidden by people in the Netherlands. I remember that I interviewed a woman who reminded me that the only word in Dutch that was known by everyone in the world was apartheid. And I was like, that's interesting.
It's a Dutch word.
Yes, it's Dutch. So it means that, you know, the country has been able to, you know, to export a word that is very meaningful when we speak about race. And maybe we can share also what happened about Zwarte Piet and all the resistance to remove that very racist tradition that was, you know, shown in like the Facebook group and like when the person from the UN came and said that it was obviously racist because it was blackface and how, you know, people reacted and said that it was not connected to race at all and that the tradition shouldn't be removed and, you know.
Well, I've been, we call the in the Netherlands an anti-Zwarte Piet activist for a couple of years now. And it is.
Excuse me. Can you just explain, for the French audience, what is Zwarte Piet and
yes. So
Black
the Dutch
Piet,
have yeah. Yes, definitely. I will do that. Good that you ask me. The it's in on the 5th of December. The Netherlands has the Sinterklaas celebration. So that's a saint who brings gifts to. I think it's the Dutch version of the Santa Claus, and instead of Christmas, but. He has servants, and those servants are of Moorish descent, so they are black, and they are the servants. And but this is a story that has a history, you know. There's always also said, like before that, you know, the servants were only played out and not necessarily face painted. But the reality we have now is that these servants are black-faced, so white people paint them, their faces black, and Black Piet has to be this. Happy, jolly, dancing, submissive character that helps Santa Claus give out the gifts to the children. But also in children's songs, he is used as, you know, something bad, something dangerous. Like, you know, even there's a line that says, even if you're not, you know, I'm going to paraphrase, even if you don't look like him, even though I am black, I'm not bad. That's what Zwarte
Piet. Oh my God,
that's too nice.
Ook al ben ik zwart als rood, toch ben ik goed. So even though I am, so
it's not only black. Like it's not only painting the face. They also wear an afro. You know,
they wear an afro. They do red lipstick.
Exactly.
Big hoops. Big yes. Golden hoops. But also the dress is mm-hmm. something from, you know, Moorish servants back in the days. And
accents. At some point, they introduced like the Surinamese Dutch accent, the black Surinamese accent. So Zwarte Piet has a black Surinamese accent. And still they're saying all of this happened because the black peats came through the chimney. So basically, if you're blonde and you have straight hair and blue eyes, if you go through a chimney, magically you transform into a black person.
Yes, yeah. That's such a lie.
First whole country. They're supposed to be advanced.
Yeah. And so you have people in the streets that like when it's time for celebrating Santa Claus, they just dress themselves into black peat.
Yes, and their children.
Oh my god!
And
like they do that in the streets. There is no okay.
Yeah. So you know, Santa Claus comes from Spain by boat, but he brings all his servants. He brings Zwarte Pieten. He brings them Black Piet. He brings them with him, and then they do a parade.
In every city, there's a parade in every city.
Is it still happening now?
Yes.
And how, as teenager and children, when you were a kid, when you were a teenager, when you saw those parades in your city, how did you feel? And how did it impact your self-esteem?
This thing, I think, Mariam, I don't know, I'm interested in your experience because I did not grow up here. I was 14 when I came here. So I was never exposed to, there are a lot of black people who are exposed to it when they're born here. And they go, and their parents choose to let them celebrate the festivities because it's specifically a children's party. But a lot of black parents choose to not include black peat in the celebrations. Whereas I was already 14. My father was a revolutionary. He was an imperial revolutionary. The first thing he did, we came on the 1st of December to the Netherlands. First time we came, he sat us down and his friends gave us presents. They said from Sinterklaas gave you presents, which was like, it was very nice. They gave us gloves and scarves because it was really cold. I came from a very warm country. My ears were freezing off. That's what I, and my nose. And after the guests left, he said, you know what? Black Piet is racist. Number one, he says, we don't do that. I'm like, okay. So that's my first encounter was already, okay, this is not something that I need to even pretend to like. So it was something that I was aware of from the day that I set foot here. So and also because I grew up in Amsterdam, which is a very racial city, I was able to avoid it entirely. It was easy to avoid. But if you don't live in a city.
Yeah. Well, I do think that I did not grow up in a big city. But it really depends, I think, what Abisa says, if you are, I know she went to a school with only people of color and only migrants. So, but I was born and raised here. And I do remember seeing it for the first time and me being petrified. I was shocked. I was completely shocked. My father is he would not, it's a funny thing, my father would not identify as black, but he would identify as Arab, but it is a black one. He had an afro and it reminded me of my dad. But I thought it was scary. What I always thought was so scary is that they paint their faces black, but the inside of their eyes stays white. So I was new, like, this is very, very strange. Now, of course, but at home we would not celebrate it at all. I think one time I told my mom I want a present for Santa Claus, and then she bought me like I remember the Teresa Barbie, that was the brown Barbie. But other than that, I always found it a very weird, I did not necessarily know it was racist. I'm not going to admit and say that I always knew that it was racist. I did know that it had something to do about people that are black. But it was until 2000, for me personally, until 2011, when one of our favorite activists, Quincy Gario, stood next to the one of those parades with a T-shirt that said "Zwarte Piet is racisme," Black Piet is racism, and he was arrested for it.
He was arrested for wearing a T-shirt.
Violently, he was beaten. This is a black man. He was beaten down and arrested for just wearing a T-shirt alongside that parade, and that sparked really physical demonstrations alongside the parade. Now, there has always been, you know, especially black activists, especially black women who have spoken out against this racist caricature. But then really physical demonstrations started alongside the parade, and that used to become very violent by the police. Police would really beat up activists, would corner them, mass arrests, all because you said that character is racist.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah. Which was the proof that it was racist, like, because beating a person on for the only reason of, you know, Quincy Gallo, because he was wearing a T-shirt, that really means, you know, they just proved him good, like, they just made his point, actually.
Absolutely.
By arresting him so brutally.
And this really echoes with everything that's happened since May 2020, I don't know about the Netherlands, but here in France, we have heard a lot in the media about Black Lives Matter from the USA, but also from black men in France that have died under the hands of the police. And also statues of colonial figures being beheaded, we say déboulonné in French, which means not only beheaded, but they were taken down.
Yes. Yeah.
Is this something that is happening also in the Netherlands, given the colonial history and the presence of racism in the institutions?
One thing that I think is important that we want to discuss is the fact that we need to be Europe. Should be in conversation with each other, because we tend to look at what's also because of the Black Lives Matter movement. We look too much towards the States.
Yes,
yeah, and definitely not be in conversation with each other, because we have so many similar stories. And the thing is, especially in our community, in the activist community, we're very much aware of police brutality in France. We're very much aware of what's going on there.
Okay, interesting. Okay,
if we don't speak the language, we know that it's like one of the brutal repression that's happening in France. We're aware of it.
Okay.
The interesting thing about, so when my friends from Morocco moved to Paris to study there, I used to visit a lot, and we walked on the Marche de la Dignité.
Yeah, it was in 2015.
It was one of the most impressive demonstrations I have seen. France does have it has a stronger history of protest than the Netherlands does. So it makes sense to the images we see from France, from riots, we're kind of used to them, because it's not all, we're not used to them always thinking, oh, it's rioting, so it must be people of color. No, there was the, you know, when it comes to labor rights, we know that the France and even in Belgium have a much stronger history of that. So when we see that we kind of know that in the Netherlands. And of course, when I remember the story, and of course, there are many stories after that, the story of Ziad Mbouna in France, that is, you know, something that still till today, there's no justice for it. But in the Netherlands, I always say the Netherlands has the best PR team you can dream of. They have the best public relations team you can dream of. In the Netherlands, relatively, we're only 17 million people. There is a lot of police brutality, but there are ways to cover it up. There is a way of covering up as something, as a confused person, we don't have the transparency. We don't have in the Netherlands really also the infrastructure to monitor that in the way that we have it in France. And that creates this image that also during when we had the Black Lives Matter demonstrations, there was one that we organized in The Hague specifically about police brutality, and that became a very sensitive topic, because here we still, like, I know the French, and I won't say them, I know how police is being called and cursed in French, but in the Netherlands, there's still a, they really have a very strong PR team where even talking about police violence is like, oh, but why are we trashing the people that are supposed to protect us? And that is a little bit what's going on right now here in the Netherlands.
It's really interesting to see your point of view from another European country, because I never really thought of this as, you know, for the French people, because we, as you said, Ebise, we always look at the USA and we never look at ourselves the same way. And it's really nice to hear what another European country has to say about the French activism and the protests that are.
It's France is inspiring for us.
Oh, really?
It's
inspiring because.
Thank you.
Because I think it's also the Dutch system of it's called Polderen, where it's a multi-party system, and there's always a coalition. Mm. There's always a large coalition where four or five parties are involved. So, like, always compromising is how they have survived and become one of the richest countries in the world. They're merchants.
Mm-hmm.
The merchant always finds a middle way. And as a result, that has become part of our DNA. Also, like the people of color and the colonial subjects, we have internalized this compromising and nuance and always finding the middle way. So protesting, going marching, revolution, fighting is not part of our DNA either. Mm. Not just the indigenous white Dutch, but also like the Afro-Caribbean subject who've been a colonial subject for over hundreds of years. It's not part of our modus operandi, whereas me coming from Ethiopia, yes, we did, because it's also my own personal history. But indeed, when you look at France, it doesn't, I mean, the 35-hour work week.
Yeah. We don't compromise. We have problems, but when people are angry, you can feel them being angry. Yeah, they don't hide that.
And that is something inspiring, and we wish it is for Dutch people to be more.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for sharing that. You. That's so interesting. Mm.
And I want to say also, as a East Asian person, and here French Asians have been speaking up against anti-Asian racism that has targeted Asian people especially since COVID-19 crisis, because it's even more visible. And I want to talk about one account that I'm following on Instagram. It's an account called, sorry, I really don't speak Dutch, so it's really, I'm not like Mariam who can put French words at the end of her sentences. It's called Bruge Kasmet Sambal, and it's an account raised. Yes.
Oh.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you very much. And it's an account raising awareness and exposing racism against the Asian community in the Netherlands. And it's very, I really like this account, because I can see, and I think it's important for us Europeans to unite, because we are facing the same problems. And so I know if there are listeners from the Dip South podcast that also want to have a look at it in the Netherlands, or it's mostly written in Dutch and sometimes in English. But it's really interesting to know that we're not alone in this.
Hmm. Yes.
And sorry, what does it mean that the
broodkaas means broodkaas is a very typical Dutch. You know, like you French, you have your baguette.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. We have broodkaas, which means like basically a sandwich with cheese.
Okay.
Gouda cheese.
Okay.
Of course, the Asian. What is it? What is sambal?
It's like hot sauce. It's like Asian hot sauce.
Okay.
Okay.
Lovely. Thank you. Thank you for the
transition. So thank you so much. It was so, it was so nice to share.
It's too fast.
Like I have so many questions to ask you. I hope we have another episode to hear more about your experience in the Netherlands. And there is so much to share. I totally agree with what you said about the fact that we need to share more about what's going on in Europe, like not only in the Netherlands and France, but also in Germany, in Northern, Europe, in Scandinavia, in other countries, because we don't hear much about that. I think it's due to the languages because it's very difficult for us to access to some information that are in local languages. But still, we need to make that effort.
Women of color unite.
Yes.
We can do this. I mean, it's also possible to do this like structurally and try to find some kind of connection.
To check in with each other.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Definitely. Mm-hmm.
And when, like policy, which affects all of us.
Like, for example, just recently there was a European resolution in the parliament to make the slave trade a crime against humanity. So that affects all of us. And it was something that was brought to the EU parliament by European MPs. So that's something that we could,
absolutely,
be proud of and share together. Maybe there is some policies that we can try to implement or to push from our, home countries.
Mm. Yes. I always say our victory is in uniting, because other than that, we're
definitely
just battling our own little beefs, Oh, no, I'm Moroccan, I don't have a problem with the French Union.
Well, thank you so much, Ibise and Mariam.
Thank you.
And Dipsas, and hope to talk to you soon, and please subscribe to Dipsas and to Kif Taras, and hopefully we can meet again soon.
Definitely.
Thank you.
Merci beaucoup.
Merci. Au revoir.
Au revoir.
Au revoir.
À bientôt.
À bientôt. À bientôt. Merci d'avoir écouté cet épisode de Kif Taras bonus en anglais avec les femmes de Deep South, le podcast néerlandais sur les questions raciales, notre podcast podcast jumeau. Ouais. Vous pouvez bien sûr nous faire part de cet échange sur les réseaux sociaux avec le hashtag Kif Taras sur Twitter et aussi le @Kif Taras sur Twitter, sur Facebook et sur Instagram.
Kif Taras est un podcast de Binge Audio, aujourd'hui enregistré par Zoom et réalisé par Adèle Itel Elmadani, à l'édition Camille Rogage et Naomi Titi. Merci Grace.
Merci Rokaya.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.